From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. Here's today's lineup. What's coming up on TV in the coming months? Well, how about a famous stand-up in the next season of Fargo? Then comedian Cristela Alonso has a new memoir and live show, but fans are still curious about her short-lived sitcom.
When people ask me if I will ever bring the show back, I always say it would be absolutely impossible because that would mean working with people that tried to ruin my dream from the get-go.
And the real science that inspired Dracula, Frankenstein, the Mummy, and the Creature from the Black Lagoon, all that coming up on The Frame. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Twice a year, TV critics from around the country gather to hear executives from broadcast networks, cable channels, and streaming services talk about what's coming out in the months ahead. The meetings are called the TCAs for the Television Critics Association. Daniel Feinberg, the chief TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, joined us direct from the gathering to give us an update on the first few days of announcements. The Fox network is presenting in the wake of Disney, which runs ABC, buying up a lot of Fox's other businesses.
They obviously couldn't be happier with the fact that Masked Singer has become the sensation that it is, because that really helped ease what could otherwise have been a rather desperate transition. So for them, the fact that they were able to have this homegrown, out of nowhere, fairly low cost, really popular smash, it makes everyone's job a significant amount easier.
So as part of the deal that brought a lot of Fox assets to the Disney lot, Disney's TV network, ABC, is now run by some former Fox executives. What is ABC up to, and what does it have to prove?
ABC is still trying to figure out the place that they occupy in the Carrie Burke administration. They continue to talk about things like going after young female viewers, and that's obviously a thing that they're going after. So they're doing things like a sort of, not exactly Dracula spin-off, but Dracula-inspired series about Dracula's brides. They're announcing more projects in the Bachelor family. I believe Bachelor Listen to Your Heart is the thing that they announced the other day that some people were excited about. And then they continue to make this push towards live programming more and more and more. They announced, for reasons that I do not understand, that their next live musical is going to be Young Frankenstein, which is not a very good musical, but I guess no one asked me. So yeah, that's what ABC is doing. They're trying to go after young women, and they're trying to emphasize live and event programming, which is a reasonable strategy in this landscape.
I want to ask you about FX. They announced a fourth season for Atlanta, the Donald Glover series. As far as I know, there hasn't been a third season yet. What's going on with Donald Glover, aka Childish Gambino series?
Well, they had already kind of announced it. What they did was they clarified how the next two seasons are going to work. And they're going to be shot back to back. And the first of the seasons is going to be 10 episodes. The second season, as of now, is only going to be 8. But if Donald Glover says to FX, I need the money to do 9 or 10 or 13, FX will say, OK, please, thank you. The way that John Landgraf put it was that the first of the two seasons is likely to premiere, and then the second is likely to premiere significantly later. Basically, if you're doing the math, that means two different Emmy cycles, which, you know, to some degree is the thing that folks care about. But yes, at least two more upcoming seasons of Atlanta, 10 episodes and 8 episodes.
We're talking with Daniel Feinberg at The Hollywood Reporter about the Television Critics Association tour. And they also showed a trailer for the next season of Fargo with Chris Rock. That looks pretty good. In terms of previews of upcoming shows on other networks, what's creating the most buzz?
So far, the buzz has been fairly quiet, and that probably is just reflective of who we've had going thus far. I definitely don't think anything has been buzzier than the first trailer for Fargo, because we haven't seen a season of Fargo since 2017, which seems like a million years ago, because Noah Hawley has been doing so many things since then. He's done multiple seasons of Legion. He had Lucy in the Sky, which allegedly was a movie that existed. He's been just very, very busy, and so Fargo has been not his top priority, but it was so good to to see footage from Fargo, to hear some of the characters talking, to hear at least Irish actress Jessie Buckley doing a Minnesota accent, and to go, ah, it's good to have that back on TV. So definitely that is the thing I certainly am looking forward to most. But if you check back with me in a week, we will have had HBO and a bunch of the cable and streaming networks, and I am sure that there will be some buzzy trailers coming soon.
So among the streaming networks, Hulu, Amazon, and Apple Plus are all going to make presentations, but Netflix is sitting out again. Any word on why Netflix is avoiding the TCAs?
You make that sound so active. And on one hand, you make it active when you say avoiding the TCA. On the other hand, it's passive when you say sitting out. And I think the answer is somewhere in between, that Netflix is basically... it's its own thing at this point, and it moves at its own pace in its own way, and Netflix does not feel like it needs the same media coverage that maybe other services do. And whether they're right or wrong about that, I'm not sure, because certainly Netflix still has countless shows that premiere and really don't make a ripple, and that if they could have put them in front of the critics, might have made more of a ripple. Like, to me, a show like Tuca and Birdie, which was canceled after one season, if they had been able to put that in front of a room of TV critics and get Tiffany Haddish and Ali Wong out there talking about the show more aggressively than they did, maybe it would have been more successful. But, you know, it's not for me to tell Netflix whether it's doing its job right or wrong as a collective entity, because they seem to feel like they're doing okay.
I know, as hard as you might try, you're probably not going to be able to see the probably close to 600 series that will be on TV and streaming services this year. But based on a glimpse or a trailer, is there a new series or show that you're really excited to take a look at?
Things like, I don't know, Picard. We're going to have CBS All Access here in a day or two. People are looking forward to that. People are looking forward to maybe seeing more of these long-discussed Marvel TV shows from the Marvel Cinematic Universe that are going to be on Disney+. At least one or two of those are likely to come out before the end of the year. There is plenty of TV, and the upcoming release of Quibi. And Quibi, and if people don't know, it's Quick Bites, has already announced that it's going to be doing 3 hours of new or original programming every day from its launch this spring. So that doesn't even count because it's short form. Oh my goodness, you could spend the rest of your life watching TV. Fortunately, that's what I do.
Daniel Feinberg is the chief TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter. He joined us from the TCAs. Daniel, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Always a pleasure.
And just to clarify, those next two seasons of Donald Glover's Atlanta are not expected until 2021. Coming up on The Frame, comedian Cristela Alonso has a new memoir and a newfound passion for performing. Comedian Cristela Alonso made waves in 2014 when she was the first Latina to create and star in a sitcom. That show, called Cristela, lasted only a year, and it was an experience that taught her a lot about the challenges facing women of color in Hollywood. Cristela joined us in front of a live audience at KPCC last fall. After a few quiet years, she reemerged with a memoir titled Music to My Years, a mixtape memoir of growing up and standing up. But first, she started off with some of her new stand-up set that she calls My Affordable Care Act.
My first language is Spanish. My mom never learned to speak English, so I had to learn English by watching TV shows like The Price is Right. And white people, you messed with me. Plinko's not a real word. I had no idea. I used to love that word. I used to say it all the time. I feel Plinko today, but it's not real. So I had to watch TV, and I would imitate what I heard on TV. So in my family, I'm the only one that doesn't have a super thick Mexican accent. My oldest brother, he was born in Mexico, and he's got a stereotypical accent. This guy sounds like a taco. You know what I mean? He's just like, hey, sister, you want to go get something to eat? And I'm like, well, we could do that. Or would you like to see what's behind door number 3? Come on down, you know?
When you were watching TV, listening to music, and then when you go off to high school, was there a time when you started realizing that what you could share as a performer made people laugh?
I actually found out that I could entertain people with my mom. My mom was an undocumented woman from Mexico who spent, I would say, about 20 years of her life trying to get her resident alien card. And I always say the name of it because I want people to know what it's called, the Resident Alien card. Coming from a background like that, if you're not familiar with it, you really don't understand what it entails to be undocumented here. My mom never got to see her family again. And I would see my mom very sad at times. And as a kid, I never wanted her to be sad. So I started making her laugh whenever I saw her face. And it was this connection that I had that started with my mom that actually allowed me to always try to find the person that looked the saddest or that had the roughest time and try to entertain them, because that was all I could afford to give, which was myself. And I think that's kind of how I still treat comedy.
I want to ask you about your show, Cristela, and how that came about. And you share some of the stories about it in the book. When you look back in writing the book about that experience, do you remember it differently now that you have perspective?
Now that I look back on it, I look back on it in a different experience because it's been so many years that you also gather new information and time evolves, and then you realize that what was really never was the way that it was presented to you. I don't regret anything, any feelings, any thoughts, any decisions, nothing that I made. But I do look back and realize that people that loved the show, I think, really loved the story of the show. Having known what happened and having time passed, I realized that when people ask me if I will ever bring the show back, I always say it would be absolutely impossible because that would mean working with people that tried to ruin my dream from the get-go.
Do you think the world has changed in any way? Do you think that there is an openness to understanding and representing different cultures, different stories?
It hasn't changed. Representation still sucks. It'll always suck if we still have the same gatekeepers, same tastemakers in powers of position. All we get to do is find new ways of exploiting a culture. I'll tell this story. I did a panel at the Ford Foundation in 2015 where the show had just been canceled, and I was doing a panel about diversity, of course. And I was doing it with my friend Jeff Yang, who's a kid, Hudson, is on Fresh Off the Boat. And we're talking about our experiences, you know, with the network, blah, blah, blah. And he goes first because his show is still on the air. And he talks about how lovely everybody is and blah, blah, blah. And then after he was done, I'm like, I had the opposite experience to you. And then I realized when he spoke that it was because that year, the head of casting for ABC and the head of comedy development were both Asian women. So they understood what the show was trying to do. It was personal. And that's what we need. We need the personal ties. There was no Latino in charge of anything when I had my show. And when people talk about, like, you know, oh, but we have these opportunities and more diversity, more representation, again, it's what I call agenda porn. It's these issues that we come up with that are now hot topic, which we gather from the media. So it's like, what is the media showing? Deportations, immigration. So those are the stories we tend to see. One of the reasons that I think I was, you know, that people always saw me as difficult was because I asked why a lot. You know, and I always ask people, like, why aspirational? What do you mean, first of all? What do you mean when you say aspirational? I learned that by aspirational, they meant successful. They wanted to show stories of successful people. Well, my whole thing is aspiration is you have to see the ascension of a journey. You have to see that regular person thriving and trying to succeed, because then you know that you have hope. That's the aspiration. The aspiration is to see someone like you on TV and know that if they made it, then there's a chance that you made it. So until we can get rid of the words multi-generational and aspirational, we'll never make any movement.
We're talking with Cristela Alonzo about her book, Music to My Years, a mixtape memoir of growing up and standing up.
You guys, I'm 40 years old. I just got health insurance like 2 years ago, man. It is a game changer. Like, people in my neighborhood wear Chanel. I wear like empty prescription bottles, like right here. Like, I'm like, that's right, bitch, antibiotics. Boom, try that. I feel rich, man. I go to Beverly Hills, I look for rich people. I'm like, that's right, homie, we both balling now. How does it feel? You know how rich people like to tell you they're rich? They're like, we just got back from Paris. I'm like, I just got back from LensCrafters. I know, look at this, I know. Like, we saw that Eiffel Tower. I saw that stop sign right there. I know, look at this, I know. Look at this. We're killing it, give it up. Ah. After the election, I stopped doing stand-up. I kind of quit because I felt really guilty trying to make money off of my community, because I knew that the people that came and saw me, they were gonna need the money. I felt guilty. I felt guilty trying to make a living because the people that went to see me, that support me, they're like my family, like how I grew up. And I just felt so selfish. And I stopped doing stand-up, and I started going around and helping people. And for the next couple years, I started going around and just visiting communities and really trying to help grassroots from anything that I could do. And I realized that stand-up wasn't important. I love stand-up. I love stand-up. And I love it so much. But when the 2016 election happened, for me, there was something bigger. And now, with my stand-up, I use it to talk about my experiences. I don't talk about the person directly, because you might not agree with my truth, but you can't deny that it's my truth.
In your new show, My Affordable Care Act. Yes, thank you. In your new show, My Affordable Care Act, and in your book, you share stories about yourself. And there's a way that audiences can understand something about you that they didn't understand before. How do you hope people might understand themselves in a different way?
I come from like a blue collar working class family. We all have jobs, you know, like the idea of stand-up is a luxurious job. The idea that you can get paid to think and write is very excessive, you know. I come from a family where everybody works hard, and by 40, your back hurts. Your knees are done, you know. And in that kind of community, for me, we were never taught that we mattered, because the family's so busy trying to get by that we never tell each other that we matter. So it's this thing where I have no idea what it was that made me not quit. And honestly, I always say that I think it's the poverty, where it made me feel like I have nothing to lose, that kept me going. And as I kept going, I started learning that there's a lot of stuff that we don't talk about that's so on the surface and so basic that people just want to know that someone out there that maybe they see on TV occasionally is just like them, regardless of skin and culture. I mean, I used to do college gigs. People used to always be surprised that as a Latina comic, I would fill up these shows in like Wisconsin, Iowa, you know, like, because everybody assumed that I would only play Latino markets. But I was also raised in like a Catholic family, working class family. And it's weird when you have that experience, you find a connection with people. I always say, if you're honest, people will find you. And you can't make them hurry. And this has been a lifelong dream for me, so it takes a lifetime. And I'm in no hurry because I've got nothing else to do.
Cristela Alonso is a writer and a comedian. Her new book is Music to My Years, a mixtape memoir of growing up and standing up. It's out now. Cristela, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you for everybody coming out. Thank you.
Up next on The Frame, the classic horror movies that were inspired by real science.
We don't believe you. Cause we the people are still here in the rear, yo. We don't need you. You ain't a killing off good young move.
Dracula, Frankenstein, The Mummy, and Creature from the Black Lagoon are classic scary movies with something else in common. They were all inspired by real science. That's the focus of a current exhibit at LA's Natural History Museum called Natural History of Horror. The Frame contributor Colin Friesen tells us more.
The Natural History of Horror exhibit isn't the largest display at the Natural History Museum, but on this rainy weekday, it's drawn a crowd. Standing by a man-sized costume for the creature from the Black Lagoon, Chris, a self-described longtime horror fan, says the attraction to spooky stuff is simple.
The creatures and the stories, definitely. Like, just the fantasy aspect of it.
And he's right, of course. It's a fantasy. There is no actual creature from the Black Lagoon, or an actual Dracula, or, well, there was a mummy, but not the mummy. You get it. But what this exhibit tries to show people is that behind the fantasy, you can find the unique scientific underpinnings that inspired some classic Hollywood horror.
The creature suit is on loan. The original doesn't survive, unfortunately. And then this mask is a pull from the original cast, but that doesn't survive either.
That's senior exhibition developer Sarah Crawford, who put this show together.
So the story we're talking about in this section is about a coelacanth, if you've ever heard of the coelacanth.
I hadn't, but it turns out a coelacanth is a big, ugly fish with gills and a lung that was considered the missing link in our evolutionary move from the water to the land. It was discovered a few years before they made the creature from the Black Lagoon, and its existence kind of makes the possible existence of the creature logical.
What was it? Science didn't know, but dedicated scientists were willing to risk their lives to find out.
This lungfish, the bridge between fish and the land animal. This one was a failure. It hasn't changed in millions of years. But here we have a clue to an answer.
Move a little further inside, and you'll get an explanation about how, without rabies, we might not have been gifted with Dracula.
Some scientists think that the vampire legend was inspired by rabies. If you look at the symptoms of both, they're kind of similar. When you are infected with rabies, you get over-sexualized, you get hydrophobic, you get averse to strong smells, you snarl, and then also two of the major rabies carriers, bats and wolves, are the very creatures that Dracula can shift into.
Now, people have always taken things that scare them, that they don't understand, and come up with fantastic and magical explanations. And what this exhibit does so well is reverse that, to show the natural or scientific discovery that got us these horror stories in the first place. Take our old pal Frankenstein, who might never have existed without an Italian doctor-slash-inventor-slash-philosopher who had some kind of weird hobbies.
Luigi Galvani, who was a scientist in the late 1700s, he basically was trying to figure out what made animals move. And so he took some severed frog legs, put them outside, attached a metal wire to them, and waited till they got struck by lightning. This caused the frog legs to move. So he thought, okay, I've discovered the secret to life. You might recognize that scene from Frankenstein, right? So Mary Shelley was very inspired by science and contemporary science, and she followed the work of Luigi Galvani and mentions him in her introduction to the book.
It's alive. It's moving. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. Oh, in the name of God. Now I know what it feels like to be God.
To illustrate this point, they'll let you zap real electricity through a fake frog's leg to simulate that great moment in scientific, if not frog, history. And over at the Dracula section, you can even play with some of the old-school Foley devices used to make sound effects for the movie, like coconuts for horse hooves and a sheet of metal for thunder. And finally, there's the movie The Mummy.
King Tut's tomb opening was an incredible media sensation. And actually, the Times of London was given exclusive rights to cover the tomb being opened, and so all of these other media outlets started inventing stories about what was happening because they had nothing else to cover. And so that's how you get this idea of the curse, which became very popular and then, of course, inspired the movie The Mummy.
Crawford says in addition to being an entertaining look back at some little-known cinematic cause and effect, they'd like their exhibit to get people to think more critically about the things they encounter every day.
You know, science can appear to be boring or old and, you know, kind of fusty to people. And so to connect it to something in popular culture, you know, helps us and helps visitors maybe think about things they encounter in their daily life a little bit differently.
Is that the goal, to give someone their serving of vegetables but disguise it as really fun entertainment?
No, I hope that they start seeing the vegetables as tasty. That's kind of my hope.
Fine, tasty with a side of scary then. The Natural History of Horror exhibit runs until April 19th. For The Frame, I'm Colin Friesen.
And that is all for today, but don't forget to tune in to The Frame Weekend, Saturday afternoon at 2. The show is produced by Darby Maloney, Monica Bushman, Jonathan Shiflett, and Julia Paskin, with help this week from Emily Henderson. Eduardo Perez is our engineer. Andrea Gutierrez is our news clerk. The Frame's theme music is by Taylor McFerrin, and the show's senior producer is Oscar Garza. I'm John Horn. Be sure to tune in early Monday when we'll have news about the Academy Award nominations during Morning Edition, right here from the Moen Broadcast Center. Thanks for listening.